Every 4 years, sports fans around the world are glued to their TVs or bar stools as the beautiful game is featured during World Cup play. Considered one of the most important tournaments in soccer, this year's World Cup contenders are gathered in Russia chasing after the Golden Trophy. 2018's favorites to win the tourney include perennial powerhouses Germany, Brazil, Spain, and France, while Belgium is seen as a team poised to pull off an upset. While commentators will be focusing on the fleet footwork and deft dribbling of the sports stars, analysts will be crunching numbers, trying to figure out if the secret to a team's success lies somewhere in sports data. The statistics of the beautiful game are the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me in the studio are regular panelists John Baylor, chair of Miami Statistics Department, and Richard Campbell, chair of Media, Journalism, and Film. Our guest today is Luke Bourne, an assistant professor of statistics at Simon Fraser University and the vice president of strategy and analytics for the Sacramento Kings. He's also one of the authors of a piece in Significance magazine exploring the world of soccer stats. Thanks so much for being here today, Luke.
Happy to be here.
I love soccer, but I have a ton of friends who have no idea what's going on in the game. They love American football, they love baseball, they love basketball, but they have a really hard time sort of following what's happening on the soccer pitch. When you're talking about soccer statistics, how are those different from say, baseball stats or basketball stats?
Yeah, one of the big differences with soccer is that there's just so much less scoring. So in basketball or baseball, there's with all the scoring that happens, all the home runs, all the three-point shots in basketball, et cetera, you get a lot of outcomes that you can use to measure players and to sort of understand the players that are good, teams that are good. In soccer, where you have a lot less scoring, there's a lot more randomness. And so as a result, you have a lot more upsets, and it becomes a lot harder to figure out who are the good players and who are the bad ones.
You know, one question that I have is what's the breadth of analytics in soccer? What are the, you certainly think about things like player assessment, but what else have you seen analytics used for in soccer?
Yeah, I think it's used for a variety of things. As you mentioned, it's used for player valuation, recruitment, figuring out who to bring into the team and who to let go. So that's things like which players are skilled in the right ways, but it's also used tactically to understand, sort of, you can think of it as like opponent scouting, where you're thinking about, okay, what are the types of tactics that my opponent is going to employ, and how can we adjust our tactics to counter that? So that's a big piece of how it's used as well. And probably the third way is in performance, so health and wellness, where teams are using lots of data on their players to make sure that they're well-rested, that they're fit, that they're not fatigued coming up to games.
So you've spent some time working at a professional club.
Yeah, that's right. I spent a little over a year at AS Roma, which is a club in Serie A that actually made it far this year. That's probably on people's minds because they made it far in the Champions League this year. And so I was there last year and spent some time in Rome, which was just delightful.
Can you talk a little bit about what did you do for the club? What was sort of your responsibility as someone who's a quantitative guy working for a soccer club?
Yeah, and were you responsible for them doing well?
like most teams, there's a lot of people involved. And so I'd like to think that I was in some sense a part of that, building tools and infrastructure to help make those decisions. But ultimately, there's lots of players involved. There's lots of coaches and performance people. And ultimately, it's the players on the pitch that are the ones that deliver. So what did I do there on a day-to-day basis? Basically, help the organization be more objective and data-driven in their decision-making, and then also provide all the tools and infrastructure to support those decisions. So lots of models and visualizations to help measure player value, understand opponent tactics, and then also get at player fatigue and fitness and that kind of thing.
So I read your piece in Significance. So I'm wondering, how do you explain what you're doing to players? Or do you have to do that? Or how do you explain it to coaches so they know what you're doing?
Yeah, that's a good question. For the most part in professional sports, communication with the players goes through the coaches. And this is definitely true when I was in soccer, and it's true now in basketball as well. So for the most part, you're dealing with coaches. You do occasionally have interaction with players as well, but it's usually a little bit of a different focus. With coaches, it really depends on the coach. So some of them are really into looking at analytical views of their opponents and their players. Others, the way that they think about the game is through video. And so sometimes what we do is instead of thinking about, okay, let's give this coach or this trainer a spreadsheet of numbers, let's give this to the work with the video guys to produce a clip of the coming opponent that's going to be more objective and more data driven. So instead of having the video guy just go watch the upcoming opponent's last two or three matches, let's give him all the tendencies of that opponent so that he can cut up a film clip for the coach, which is going to be more accurate to what that team's actual tendencies are.
You mentioned a couple of times the sort of defensive way that you can use analytics in soccer. And I'm wondering, so if I'm Spain and I'm trying to make sure that Belgium isn't going to cause an upset in World Cup play, if I'm looking at this video, what am I looking for as far as sort of things to help me understand analytically how to sort of ensure that upset doesn't happen?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things. First off, as you can imagine, it's fairly straightforward with the current data to understand which players are the sort of key drivers of offensive actions. So by that I mean, if you just look at sort of the sequence of players that the ball passes through, maybe from goalkeeper all the way through to the striker who takes the shot, you can see tendencies within the team. Do they go up the left? Do they go up the right? Is it their wingbacks? Is it their? Do they go through the sort of center of midfield? And from that, teams can understand their opponent's tendencies in terms of where they bring the ball, who carries the ball, which players are more likely to create scoring opportunities. And from that, they can adjust their defense to counterbalance that.
When you started to provide input to the club, you said you were talking to them about helping the organization to become more data-driven. I'm curious, what ideas were embraced the fastest? What kind of input was really most welcomed, and what kind of input or ideas did you find the most reluctance to consider?
I think probably what I've seen universally is that the groups that are within teams that are most receptive are the performance staff. So these are strength and conditioning coaches, physiotherapists, doctors, etc. And that's largely because they've been driven by the world of sports science, which is very data focused and has been for decades. And so that was the sort of place, at least within Roma, but also with the Kings, where we got a lot of adoption and are able to create a lot of impact right away. There's other areas where it becomes a little bit harder. So if you're familiar with Moneyball, you can think about baseball, and baseball's use of data is, I tend to say that baseball is about 10 years ahead of basketball in terms of the adoption and understanding of data within the sport. And then I would say soccer is probably another 10 years behind basketball yet.
Wow.
So when you're talking with coaches and players, this just isn't a language that they're used to speaking.
Okay.
The use of data really has only been around the last few years. And because of that, coaches and players did not grow up with this level of statistical literacy around the game. And so it's probably going to be another generation before the kids coming up learn to speak that way, where they start to think about expected goals and goal differentials and pass completion percentages and those kinds of things.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and our discussion today focuses on statistics and sports. Luke, in the article for Significance, you and your co-authors are writing about the fact that there's going to be real-time player tracking available in the World Cup. How might that change the way teams can prepare and the kind of analytics they can sort of gather in their preparation for matches?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that you might see is teams overreacting to small sample sizes. if you have tracking data for one half of a match, it becomes really easy to just think that that's the way that team operates, when in fact there's a lot of variability within a game and even across games. But I do think where it'll come in is primarily on the performance side, as I mentioned earlier. It's really hard using in the sort of sample size of the World Cup, where you have a handful of games, to really identify meaningful trends and patterns in a team or a player's style of play. And so most likely what you're going to see is the teams using it really heavily for understanding the loads that the players are going through. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you have a player that's maybe playing as a central midfielder and not sort of a box to box midfielder, by that I mean someone who's sort of, you know, not covering the field, not running a lot. Mm-hmm. They might then say, okay, he's not getting a lot of, he doesn't have a lot of load during that game. In other words, he's not going through a lot of sort of physical stress. But maybe another player, like a left back, sort of going up and down the pitch over and over, has a lot more load. And as a result, in the days between games, the performance staff might actually adjust their training schedule to adjust for those different in-game loads.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about, because this is related, how wearable technology works? You know, how does it actually work? How are you gathering data with that kind of technology?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I think usually in practices and elsewhere, teams will use this wearable technology that's essentially a small, the size of sort of a couple AA batteries that goes between their shoulder blades. And it measures acceleration and different movement patterns. It can also be GPS connected as well. Hmm. Mm-hmm. But what you're going to see in the World Cup actually is an optical-based system. And so what they do there is they install several cameras around the perimeter of the stadiums. And then these are essentially just a handful of high-def security cameras. And then after that, they use image processing techniques, essentially multi-agent target tracking, to produce the coordinates of the players every 25th of a second. So they're using sort of fairly complicated machine learning techniques to sort of extract the locations of the players from these video feeds. And they do things like optical character recognition on the players' jerseys on their back to figure out which player is which. So that's the technology. So people think that it's a hardware solution that players are wearing, but actually it's coming from image processing from cameras.
Very, very interesting.
That's really cool. So they're going to be saying who's been covering the most ground. Obviously, they're going to be talking about the acceleration of these players. There's going to be all sorts of information that's going to be fed to the commentators.
Yeah, and for the most part, people who work in the sport tend to really downplay things like how far a player runs or accelerations. But it's ultimately something that the media loves. So this is actually really this gap between what people within teams use and what the media tends to focus on. And the media for sure will talk about the players that ran the longest and the sharpest accelerations. But the things that teams are looking at are more so sort of the overall impact on the player's body, which are sort of more complex metrics than that.
Mm-hmm. So what from the data that's going to be collected in real time during the World Cup is the most interesting statistical information?
I think it's hard to say, first off, what level of analytical sophistication each team will have. The thing with international squads is that they tend to be sort of off for long periods of the year, and then they come together and they meet, and a lot of them don't have dedicated analysts. Or if they do, these are people who are sort of coming from another club and just working during the World Cup. So oftentimes they don't have the time and resources to do the same level of analysis that a top-tier club in Europe might. And so I think even though this data is coming to these clubs in the World Cup, there will be, I think, a gap in the ability to turn this data into meaningful insights.
You mentioned earlier that soccer has sort of been behind the curve when it comes to analytics and statistics for team prep. Why has that been?
That's a good question. I think there could be a few reasons for that. The one is that baseball really led the way. Mm-hmm. And so whether it's due to soccer's sort of thematic distance from baseball, and by that I mean the sort of the style of the game is drastically different. Baseball's a very discreet game, and by that I mean it's sort of a pitcher batter one at a time, whereas soccer is a much more free-flowing game, so they're very different. But also there's a geographical distance, and so I think the fact that the sport has been based primarily in Europe has led to slower infiltration of data into the sport.
So do you have to do any work, again, following up on the resistance to analytics? I mean, there are, this was part of what I remember about Moneyball, the early resistance to using analytics, that a lot of coaches feel like this is a field game, that analytics doesn't have much to do with it. So do you face much of that, both in basketball and in soccer, given that they're a little far behind in terms of baseball?
Yeah, I think this is a common thing that happens when statisticians or other people who sort of work in a quantitative field go into industry from academia. So when I was in academia, we would spend all our time building these really complex, really fancy models using tracking data to answer really cool questions, and we'd present it and get lots of great feedback. And you find that in contrast, when you go into industry, you spend a lot of your time, and in fact, the majority of your time, communicating statistical information, and sometimes quite simple statistical information. And so that really is the biggest challenge. It's not coming up with the greatest metrics or the fanciest ways to measure players. It's the ability to communicate that information to coaches and others so that it can actually have an impact.
Do you have an example of that? Something that you found that you had to explain, something that was more technical, and break it down?
There's this idea in, it's actually true in both soccer and basketball. There's this notion in soccer that's become quite prominent in the last couple of years of expected goals. Mm-hmm. And the idea there is, you can imagine if a player takes a shot, and it, whether it goes in or doesn't, instead of saying, okay, this counting shots, so, you know, mm-hmm. player A got 10 shots and player B got one shot over the course of the tournament, you can instead look at the probability that each shot becomes a goal. So if someone takes a really, really great shot that has a 50% chance of going in, then they sort of get 0.5 expected goals. And in contrast, if someone takes a really long shot from way outside the box, then it might be 0.1 expected goals, for example. And this is actually sort of the equivalent in basketball of field goal percentage, mm-hmm. where looking at sort of spatially referenced field goal percentage, you know, a player might shoot 35% from this location and 45% from this other location. And so that's something that's really tricky to get across. It sounds relatively simple, but this idea that, hey, certain locations are much more valuable to get shots from, and in mm-hmm. fact, we can measure it. So in basketball, the most frustrating thing as an analyst is when you see a player go to take a 3-point shot, but they take one step inside of the 3-point line.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
A long two. And so you have to sort of get across this idea that, hey, the probability of making this shot when you take that one step forward basically stays the same. So it might be sort of a 35% shot for the three versus maybe a slight drop to like 33%. Mm-hmm. But when one of those you're multiplying by 3 points and the other one you're multiplying by 2 points. And so mm-hmm. there's a big gap. And the same thing holds true in soccer, where players, some players have these shot profiles where they take all these really long shots, and it's a really inefficient way to try and score goals. And mm-hmm. so it's much better to sort of try and get that extra pass. Even though in the end you get less shots, you're going to be better off because those are higher quality shots.
That's also frustrating as a fan to experience that. I would just like to state for the record. Today we're talking with Simon Fraser University's Luke Bourne about sports stats. You mentioned a little earlier about how media are looking for different things in stats than the people who are working for teams. And so I'm wondering if there are things about the way sports reporters or news reporters cover sports statistics, whether it's, you know, field goal percentage or shot percentage, that you find frustrating and think they could do better.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for the most part, media is not terribly adoptive of these ideas. And so, you know, I think people can remember Charles Barkley's rants against analytics and those kinds of things. And so for someone who's in the sports analytics world, for the most part, when media uses quantitative information to present the game, I think it's I enjoy it almost regardless of whether it's done well or not. But I think the biggest thing that you will see now is focusing on what I would call volume. So I think there'll be a lot of reporting of number of shots and number of passes. Mm-hmm. And really, for the most part in sports, what you don't really care too much about volume. You care a lot about efficiency. Mm-hmm. And so as an example, in basketball, if a player plays 30 minutes versus if a player plays 10 minutes, they might show these stats the same way for both players. You know, this player scored 20 points in 30 minutes and this other player scored 15 points in 10 minutes. Well, I would actually much rather have the guy who scored 15 points in 10 minutes than the guy who scored 20 in 30 minutes. So, mm-hmm. But if you're just presenting the cumulative totals without accounting for the fact of, okay, how much usage did that player get? You're missing out a lot of the nuance of the game.
I'm looking forward to seeing the box score that you develop for soccer. You know, I think, you know, part of the interest in baseball is, you know, people could go through the game and see the detailed performance of players. And, you know, you could look over the course of seasons, be able to track that. And I'm trying to picture what the equivalent of a baseball card would be for professional soccer or for the World Cup.
Yeah, I think it's only been in the last couple of years in basketball that teams have really thrown out the traditional box score and started to do something a lot more intelligent. So I think we're a ways away from something like that in soccer. But I think ideally you'd see something that is a very simple example. If you look at tackles and interceptions, so these are defensive events. So if a player intercepts a pass between teammates or a tackle is sort of when you steal the ball from another player. If you look at those counts, almost always you'll see, as an example, if you look at La Liga, you'll see Barcelona as having very few tackles and interceptions. And so you might think, oh, they weren't very good defensively. But of course, the other team almost never had the ball.
Yeah.
So it's hard to tackle the other team when they don't have the ball. So as a very simple start, you know, I can imagine that in the media, they're going to report tackles and interceptions, but they really need to be adjusting it for the amount of possession that each team had.
In Moneyball, I remember one of the things that stuck was the way that analytics helped recruit not star players, but role players.
Hmm.
Is there a similar kind of thing that's applicable in basketball and soccer where you can study data to imagine that the team needs somebody that can do a specific thing, but he's not a star?
Yeah, I think the thing about star players is that they play so many minutes and they get so much attention that for the most part, they're fairly well valued by the public. So I think, you know, you don't need analytics to tell you how great Messi is or how great Ronaldo is or any of these players. But it's the players that sort of fall behind the wayside that don't appear in the highlight clips that you can get a lot more insight in from analytics. And so as an example of that, you know, some players that might play less minutes aren't the ones involved in the goals, they might never appear. They might never be in the highlight reels, but you'll see in the data, you can see, oh, these people are actually the ones that created those opportunities, maybe three or four or five passes back from the shot.
Mm-hmm.
So you can extract that information relatively straightforwardly from the data, where it can be hard as a fan or as a even as a coach or as a scout, you tend to remember those shots and those key actions that led to goals. And so oftentimes scouts are really good at remembering those the goals and the scoring opportunities. So good at valuing sort of the scorers on the team, but maybe not so good at valuing those players that create those opportunities farther back in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. So one dimension of what you've written about in the significance piece and other work is the idea of the value of space and location. And it makes me think about some of the old the soccer coaching guidelines about preparing players to be, you know, the first attacker, second attacker, third attacker, or first defender, second defender, third defender, all those concepts of role and space and interaction with the player on ball. So how do you think you'd start to quantify? I know you've started to quantify this some, but I'm just trying to think about how are we going to read about this and report about, you know, why this player is has such important impact on space and the flow of play.
Yeah, this is actually measuring space and understanding its impact is a really hard thing to do. And one of the first projects I did with a student of mine at Harvard, Dan Cervone, who's now at the LA Dodgers, is we use this analogy to real estate. So you can imagine that if you're paying $1,000 a month for a small flat in Manhattan, and you then choose to pay the same amount for a flat that's twice as big in Brooklyn, well, that tells you something about the relative price of real estate in each of those. So in other words, even if you didn't know how much a person was paying, if you sort of see that they swap between Manhattan to Brooklyn and you look at the relative size of those two apartments, you can get a notion of the relative value in each of those two places. And the same can be done in soccer and basketball, where you look at, okay, I am in this really wide open space and I have no defenders are around me. I have lots of room. But if I choose to pass it to a teammate of mine who's maybe ahead of me and quite tightly guarded, that tells you that I value the space where he is much more value than I value the space where I am. And so by using this sort of every pass, you can think of this dynamics of trading one space, one sort of ownership space for another ownership space. And from this, you can actually get a pretty good notion of the areas of value on a pitch, but also how different players and different teams value different areas of the space.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. You know, it's interesting to me that you've talked a lot about soccer and basketball and the analogy here. And I keep thinking about soccer and hockey as maybe being more similar in terms of, you know, a lot of flow, but not, you know, without a lot of scoring.
Yeah. Hockey's a really interesting one. And one of the reasons that it hasn't caught up is largely due to a data gap. And so definitely hockey and mm-hmm. basketball and soccer are very much, I think, of the three that can learn the most from each other. And only really in the last year or two has hockey caught up in terms of data. So there's a company based out of Montreal called SportLogic that creates incredible data for hockey that's akin to this sort of tracking data. So mm-hmm. I think you're going to see hockey catch up very rapidly.
Very good. Hey, I want to know, as a frustrated basketball fan, what's the data show that hitting 3-point shots is so much harder on the road than it is at home? You see, it's like it's incredible in this particular playoff how badly the Cavaliers shoot 3-pointers on the road. Do you have data on this that suggests there are the factors that that affect players on the road?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, there's definitely a fatigue factor that comes into play. For the most part, there's not a drastic impact on shooting. Where you do see is there's a lot in terms of the calls that different teams receive. There definitely is a home field advantage, but it's not nearly as large in basketball as it is in soccer. So soccer, aside from the actual teams themselves, the home field is a huge impact. So it's this is why, for example, in the Champions League, they do home and away. So mm-hmm. they don't play single games except for the final, which is at a neutral location. For the most part, all throughout, they play a home and home, which is to say, if you have the two teams playing each other, they play one game at one team's stadium, and then a week later, they'll play at the other team's stadium. And that's to balance out the really extreme home field advantage.
What causes that? You would think in a small indoor arena like basketball, the crowd noise would have an impact. But in a large soccer stadium, why is there more of a home field advantage?
Yeah, there's been a lot of study along these lines, and some of it comes down to fatigue and definitely crowd influence. There's been studies around the officials' calls. So especially in a sport like soccer, where awarding a penalty can basically mean the difference between winning and losing a game.
Yeah.
So there's a variety of factors that come into play.
Okay.
How would someone prepare for a career like you have?
Yeah, the first thing I would say is that the funnel is really narrow. So when I started at the Kings, we hired 3 full-time staff. And for those 3 positions, we had over 1,000 applicants.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's a really challenging field to get into, but you know, there is a fair bit of jobs and it's growing. So I sort of usually start with that answer to sort of check people's expectations, that it is a very difficult field to get into. But in terms of how to get in, there's a tough balance, because if you look at the people who got into teams maybe 10 years ago, their skill sets were what you might obtain in a, in fact, a lot of them have MBAs. They're sort of really great with Excel spreadsheets and those kinds of tools. Whereas if you look at the level that teams are hiring now, they're asking for machine learning expertise and databases and scripting Python or R. The level of technical sophistication has gone through the roof. And so because of this, now it becomes even harder, because if you want to get into a team, you not only need to have this great technical sophistication, but these incredible communication skills where you can build a complex hierarchical Bayesian model, and then in the next second sit down with a coach and translate it to him. You know, someone who has maybe high school mathematics, and you have to communicate this rather complex hierarchical model. So it's this combination of really high level of technical skills that are required to work with this tracking data, which is often hundreds of gigabytes, and then at the same time be able to communicate it to a layperson really straightforwardly.
Well, thank you so much, Luke, for being here today. That's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film and the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter or iTunes. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsandstories@miamioh.edu. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.